In Scotland, when friends get together, they blether. When these three friends happen to be Scottish Blue Badge tourist guides, you can be sure that the country that they're so passionate about will be right at the heart of their discussions. Be it contemporary or historical, culinary or cultural, reminiscence or anecdote, from accommodation to zoos, the chat will range right across the entire alphabet of topics and issues that are live and happening in Scotland right now. We hope that you'll join us. There's nothing to beat a richt good blether.
And you could also join in our blethers on social media. You can find us as at Scottish Blethers on both Facebook and Instagram. We post additional content during the week that supports the podcast episode.
We love making the podcasts and would love it if you could share them with your friends and leave a review on the platform of your choice.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Scottish Blethers. I'm Liz Lister.
And I'm Helen Houston. Hello.
Hello, hello. Well, it's been some mixed weather, hasn't it? Quite a mixed bag. There was earlier on in the week beautiful blue skies, freezing cold.
Freezing cold, and then on Saturday, a great plummet of snow.
Ooh.
And I went sledging, Liz.
Very good, very good.
And I've got videos of me, which I might actually put on my Facebook page, of me plummeting down the golf course hills.
Oh dear, don't even go there, Helen. Don't even go there.
It wasn't so much the sledging that was difficult. It was the getting down onto the sledge and then getting up off the sledge. Very inelegant.
I'm sure you provided great entertainment for your grandchildren.
Oh, I think I did, yes.
Well, it's the time of year where it's a great time to be out for a walk, and no more so than in the city of Edinburgh, the capital city, because, of course, it's the city of festivals. And at this time of year, the winter festival in Edinburgh is Edinburgh Sparkles.
Yeah, and it's so good. I was in Edinburgh just last week, and, everything is going up. The big wheel is up. The entertainment is up. The Christmas trees are out. It's just fantastic. And they've got very good things in St Andrew's Square, Liz.
Yeah.
Really not just the usual, let's spend money and make money kind of thing, but it's telling us how we can actually donate things and help people who are less fortunate, which I thought was very good.
It is. And of course, the whole of George Street has got the lights on it. So it's a brilliant time to be walking around the new town. And the theme for this week's episode is people you meet on a walk through the new town of Edinburgh. Now, we're not talking about friends and acquaintances here. We're talking about the statues.
Yes, because they're just every corner you turn around, you'll come across a statue. There's all sorts of things there and they're going up and they're very interesting. They're not all the old Victorian statues. We're getting much more modern ones going up.
Yeah, statues for every generation. Yeah. But of course, the majority of them go back to when the new town was built at the end of the 18th century. It took 100 years to build it, but it started at the 18th century. And one of the design concepts then was to have what was called a terminal vista. Now, it could either have been a grand building like a church, but very often it was some form of statue. And given that if you sucked up to your monarchs at the time, if you built a good statue for them, it made you look good, then there's a multitude of statues scattered all over the new town.
That's right. And it's, it's monarchs, it's politicians, it's scientists, it's ministers. And each one has a story to tell. And each one is part of the big tapestry that is Scotland.
Yeah, so it's as if the end of each street's like a sentence. It's got a dot, which is the statue, and putting a dot at the end of it. So as you wander around, you're spoilt for choice. But starting off, the new town, it was built, started 1776. This was after the defeat at Culloden. This was the height of the House of Hanover. And so, of course, the new town is a World Heritage Site, famous for its Georgian architecture. So it's not surprising that the House of Hanover is represented here. And the first of the Hanoverian monarchs to visit Edinburgh was King George IV, and he has his own statue.
He's got a very interesting statue. You've got to look at it very carefully. I think with all this great popularity of drags and drag queen, he could be mistaken for one standing there in his plinth with his very short mini kilt on. And of course, although they're not painted on the statue, Liz, we know, according to records, that he was rather embarrassed about his legs. So he wore, well, they say flesh coloured in some books, but other books they say pink stockings.
Yeah, and I think that the statue is very flattering. You know, again, they were trying to praise their monarch and get brownie points for it, but this monarch was said to have been nearly as wide as he was tall, so they've slimmed him down a little bit in it.
Oh, he's very slim looking on the statue. But the thing that I found quite amusing was that apparently the ladies of Edinburgh just flocked to see him and were sort of swooning in the streets, moved to tears by the smell emanating from his wooden false teeth. Can you imagine?
He's what we would call in Scotland a bonny chooky.
Yes.
He was aesthetically challenged, I think we could say.
What is it they've got? They've got a lovely shop in Glasgow, which you in the old days would have made the false teeth, and it's called Glamorous Geggies. Geggy being your false teeth.
Brilliant. All these words that were thrown away here. But my claim to fame, although it's remotely, is that my husband some time ago had his ancestry done, and his family belonged to Fife, and particularly to the area around about Falkland, Pitlessy and Lindores and all those sorts of areas round about there. And if anybody's ever visited Holyrood House, then they may have seen in the dining room that there's a painting, a portrait of George IV when he came to visit in 1824, was it?
1822.
1820s, we'll agree on that. And so the artist that painted this was a man called David Wilkie, and apparently Brian's husband and him share a common ancestor, so a little famous ancestor there for the Lister family. Yep.
And of course, that painting you're talking about is also a very glamorous portrait of George IV. He looks very tall and slim in it, mm-hmm. Dressed in 84 yards of tartan.
Yeah, not just any tartan, cashmere. I mean, no money,
cashmere and silk. Yes,
fantastic. So even the bonniest of chookies could look good in that. So good old King George IV standing in the middle of George Street. And then, of course, if you think of royalty, hardly surprising that we have one of Queen Victoria. And that's relatively unusual because women are underrepresented, perhaps not surprisingly. And we're going to return to them in a future episode and look at statues specifically of women because they've come more into their own in recent times.
Yes, and I think the statue of Queen Victoria that is there, there's actually three statues of her in Edinburgh itself. But the one I think we should, since it is in the new town, we should mention that people might not have noticed that it is a statue of Queen Victoria. It sits atop the Scottish Academy, the Royal Scottish Academy, on Prince's Street. And she is dressed as Britannia. And it would appear that this sculpture was made for London, but Queen Victoria saw it and was really very upset. She thought that the sculptor had made her far too fat. She wasn't nearly as fat as that. Well, I think we all know that Queen Victoria had a fair girth on her at times. And so Edinburgh said, oh, we'll take that. And they put it atop the Royal Scottish Academy, which is very visible in the new town, but you have to look up to and think, oh, that is Queen Victoria.
Yeah, I'm sure she wasn't amused by that, being at the top of a very high profile building in the middle of the busiest street in the Edinburgh's new town. Yeah. Bit of a cruel joke there, but she's lasted well. She still sits there looking out over her people, this bronze statue. She's sitting on a sandstone pedestal and she's got a crown and her sceptre, so she looks very regal at the height of the British Empire.
Yes, and that was what she was representing as Britannia, wasn't it?
It was. And of course, you can't mention Victoria without mentioning the other half, Prince Albert, and his memorials along in Charlotte Square. which is probably the greatest example of Georgian architecture, maybe in Europe, maybe the world, but certainly in Edinburgh. And Prince Albert is there at the request of Queen Victoria.
Yes, and when John Steele did that sculpture, and when Queen Victoria unveiled it there, she was so taken by it that she more or less knighted the sculptor, John Steele, on the spot. She just thought that it was a wonderful portrayal of her beloved husband.
It was, but it took her 15 years before the statue was finally unveiled. You know, after Albert died, he died when he was 42, and it was a great shock to the nation, never mind to Queen Victoria. And the last official engagement that he'd been carrying out had been laying the foundation stone of the Chambers Street Museum. Now, he didn't have his hat on in the cold, biting wind of Edinburgh, and it was said that he caught a cold and deteriorated, and he died shortly after that. And it was 15 years before Victoria eventually came north to unveil it. But as you say, she was delighted. She knighted John Steele, the sculptor, and she also knighted the musical director, because she liked the band and the tune that the band were playing. So she was very amused on that day.
Yes. A wee smile on her face. I think maybe John Brown, her friend from Balmoral, must have been cheering her up.
But John Steele, she was so delighted with him that he went on to be the official royal sculptor in Victoria's household. And it was him that did the sculpture of her as Britannia at the top of the Royal Scottish Academy. So she didn't always like what he did, but in general, he went on to become one of the most successful sculptors. And certainly in Edinburgh, everywhere you go around Edinburgh, there are examples of his work.
Oh, yes, yes. I think It's always safe to say as a guide, this is by John Steele.
Exactly, they usually are.
Yes.
So that's into the Victorian era, and Prince Albert's memorial. It was unveiled in 1876. Also around this time, slightly earlier, we mentioned that Victoria loved coming to Scotland, and that was largely due to the efforts of Sir Walter Scott.
Yes, she was. In fact, that's really what brought her up. She was in love with his books. She just thought that his writing was fantastic and his stories were amazing. Very different taste nowadays. I am still struggling with Sir Walter Scott.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think most people do nowadays. Yeah, an acquired taste, I think.
Yes. But you listen to his descriptions, they are incredibly good. And you can understand that if the book is being read to you by somebody who can give some expression to it, that you would see, you know, through the writing, the beauty of Scotland. But it's a hard thing to do nowadays.
Yeah, well, between him and Victoria, they certainly put Scotland back on the map again with regards to tourism. And his monument, nobody that ever comes to Edinburgh could fail to see it. So it's right in the middle of Prince's Street. You can actually climb it. It's 287 steps to the top of it. And sitting right in the middle of what Bill Bryson called a Gothic space rocket, you have the statue of Sir Walter Scott himself with his hound, Maida, at his feet, a wolfhound. And it's made out of Carrara marble, white statue in the centre of it.
And it was it was covered in scaffolding sort of last year for a short period of time while he was having a bath. they covered his modesty and made him quite private for his bath.
Well, it's not actually the first time that the block of Carrara marble that he's made from has had a bath, because when it was being transported across from Laverno in Italy, it was actually, it fell off the ship and ended up in the harbour, and it had to be pulled out of the harbour before it was brought here. And George Meikle Kemp was the sculptor was given the job of producing this fantastic sculpture at the centre of the monument.
Yes, well, I'm smiling to myself because I'm thinking that we're talking about Queen Victoria. There's a statue to Queen Victoria in Dundee, and poor Queen Victoria, when she arrived, the statue arrived, they had no idea where to put her. So she languished in the wagons yard of the station for several months before they decided to put her beside the Albert Memorial.
Oh, nice. The two of them sit together in eternity.
Together, yes.
Lovely. Well, I also smile when I think of the Scott Monument, because, as people will know, both of us are guides for Rick Steves. And we usually, in good times before the pandemic, we would meet up in Edmonds for the reunion. And one year, the Seahawks, the Seattle Seahawks, were in the final of the National Football League. And we were given the task of taking a giant flag and flying it from some sort of landmark in our own home countries. And so I opted for the Scott Monument. And I got a friend, Dave Hatton, who does many of our photographs, and I got him to stand below. I persuaded the little man to let me up. And then I think he thought he had a protest on his hands as I unfurl this at the top of the Scott Monument. And he's going, "You can't put that out. You can't put that out. Come down, come down." So I got my photos and didn't get arrested, just about.
And Rick Steves made a collage of all the photographs around Europe of the Seattle Seahawks flag, or the Seahawks
12th flag, man, isn't it?
The 12th man, number 12.
Yep. But another famous monument to an author, it went missing recently, and that's the one that stands on what's called the Picardy Place Island. Now, the reason that this statue is there, it's a full life-size statue, is that 11 Picardy Place, a very famous author, was born, and that was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. But the statue isn't of him, but his most famous character, which is Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, and I took a wee walk over. It's now quite tricky to get over to that little island because it is not an island in the middle of water. It's an island in the middle of roads and tram lines. So there's quite a few crossing places to get over to it. And Sherlock Holmes is not looking up into Edinburgh. He's looking down he's looking to Picardy Place, to presumably where Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was born.
There's a pub there, a good pub called the Conan Doyle.
Yes.
He's maybe looking in there.
No, he's not, because I also went over and had a wee look at that. I didn't go in. I had a wee look at that. And and there's a story.
Aye, right.
Yes. Mind you, if anybody's, it is a very nice pub.
It is. But if you look carefully at the statue, now that it's back in place, it was removed in 2018 because they were extending the tram line down to Newhaven and they wanted to keep it safe, so they took it away. But it's now back in place. And if you have a careful look at it, when you were examining it, did you have a look between his feet?
Oh, no, I don't think I did.
Because if you do, there's two paw prints of a gigantic hound. So maybe it's the hound of the Baskervilles.
Hound
Who knows
of the Baskervilles,
what,
yes.
What these paw prints are doing at his feet. Yeah, so have
a look. That must be it. Yes, must look at that, yes.
So we've got authors, we've got royalty, and of course we've got more than our fair share of politicians as well.
Yes.
And of course it's those that, as usual, are mired in controversy that are getting into the papers and getting into the news these days. One of them is not nowadays, but in his time he wasn't too popular, and that's Sir William Pitt the Younger. Now, he was at the latter half of the 18th century, and he was asked three times to become Prime Minister, and he refused it. Well, he refused it twice. At the third time, he accepted it, and he was the UK's youngest Prime Minister at just 24 years of age.
Goodness me, that is young, isn't it?
It is.
But they didn't think he was going to last as long as he did, Liz, did they?
No.
They thought that once he was elected, he'd be out by Christmas, which gave him the nickname of
the Mince Pie Prime Minister.
Yes.
He wouldn't be around by Christmas. But he did stick around, but it was very unfortunate times during his period as Prime Minister. It was the time of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, and then leading into the American Wars of Independence. So Britain, not surprisingly, going on by what we're like today, it was £22 million in deficit because they just funded this war against the French. So to try and alleviate this national debt, he set about introducing taxes. And once he got the hang of it, he quite liked this idea of getting money from the people. So he taxed horses, tobacco, tea, sugar, even whiskey. But the one that still rankles to this day, he was the one that introduced income tax. And it was supposed to be a temporary measure going right back to 1800, still there today.
So, and I think it's gone up a bit, hasn't it?
I think so, yeah. So much for temporary measures.
And, of course, the famous saying of daylight robbery, which was income tax, but it was actually daylight robbery, was attached to the window tax that he introduced. that, you know, because glass was very expensive and, you know, people were, you know, would get into the idea of putting in big windows away from the small windows because it was a little bit easier in terms of draft, etc., you know, for the bigger windows. But he introduced a tax, window tax. So that is why when you walk around the new town and all these beautiful Georgian houses, you'll see things that look like windows that are not windows. And some say it's because of the window tax. Some say it's because, you know, the people said, well, I don't really need a window there for the inside. But the architect said, oh, Georgian architecture needs symmetry. So we will have the shape of a window on the outside.
So we don't perpetuate this idea of Scotland's meanness. You know, it was all about symmetry. That's what it was about. But yes, he was good. He was generally good, generally well-liked. His nickname was Honest Billy. If anybody's ever watched Blackadder, he appears in Blackadder as the Chancellor of the Exchequer. So William Pitt the Younger, a good guy generally, apart from the fact that he didn't manage the finances particularly well. But somebody at the opposite end of the scale that's generating lots and lots of controversy these days is Henry Dundas, Viscount Melville, First Lord of the Admiralty. And he has one of the tallest statues in Edinburgh, the Melville Monument, which was erected in 1821.
Yes, and he stands here on top of this huge pedestal. And he was sometimes referred to as the ninth King Henry, or was it Henry the Ninth or something, because he was all powerful.
Yes, he was. He governed Scotland on behalf of William Pitt. He was a staunch ally, but he was described by a Scottish Whig, the opposing party to the Tories, as Scotland's dictator, because he pretty much ruled Scotland. He was the most prominent politician in Scotland in this period, and very dominant in British politics as well.
Yes, and of course now the controversy really centres around the part he played in the slave trade, or delaying the abolition of the Atlantic slave trade. And with the Black Lives Matter campaign, etc., they're quite rightly saying, look, you must be honest about what he did. He was not all good.
Yeah, it was very controversial. You know, in 2020, with the murder of George Floyd in the States, this all came to the fore. And we had statues in Britain being tipped into the sea in Bristol and whatever, and all this outcry at slavery. And originally, it was really Glasgow that was seen as, you know, benefiting from enslaved people, because that's where all the factories were that processed all the goods that came from the plantations. Yeah. But nowadays they know that much of the wealth that built the new town in Edinburgh was built on the back of enslaved people. And so it's hugely controversial. And some people say you should remove the plaques. Others say, no, you can't rewrite history. We have to put up a plaque on it to reflect the legacy that he left by delaying the abolition laws going through Parliament.
Yes, and I think it's quite right, because I mean, literally, if you wanted to knock down everything that was built on the back of the slave trade, there would actually be nothing left for anybody to have, because the railways, the road systems, the new town, museums, schools, everything would just have to go. So it has to be told. And yeah, I think they're doing quite well in Scotland. Certainly in Edinburgh, they've got Professor Jeff Palmer at Heriot Watt University, who has been very much a leading light in this, you know, saying common sense, tell the story, don't hide it, but tell it.
But we have one of our other great historians, contemporary academic at Edinburgh University, what's the man's name? Tom Devine.
Uh-huh.
And he is pointing another picture. So it is very controversial. Of course, you've got Melville's contemporary family speaking out as well. But you've not got to look far from this 150 foot high statue in the centre of St Andrew's Square. And if you just look to where the cousin of Dundas built his own house, and it's now it was the headquarters of the Royal Bank of Scotland. It's just a branch of the Royal Bank of Scotland nowadays. But one of the governors was also up to his eyes in the slave trade, and that was Sir John Hope. Maybe some people have gone to Hopeton House in South Queensferry, and that was his family home. But he was very popular in Scotland because he was a great soldier. He had several victories for the British Army. but he was also one of the governors of the bank, which is why his statue stands. But he was involved in a battle in the Caribbean, and he put down a rebellion of the slaves in the Caribbean, and this led to slavery going on for a further 40 years. So another one, statue, but dodgy past.
Yes, but and you know, some of our listeners, you were talking about the Royal Bank of Scotland, the house there with the statue in front of it. It's still a branch, and to go into it, you do go in because it is the most beautiful interior. And the bank has kept and is very happy for people to go in to talk to you about the building of the bank and the interior.
Yeah, again, when we talk about corruption and politicians and whatever, it was mired in that he got in and bought the land before the church could be built that was intended in the original plan.
Sir Lawrence Dundas,
yes. But we're talking about academics there, contemporary academics. I mean, again, as you walk around Edinburgh, lots and lots of statues of academics, be it writers, doctors, medical, all of those fields. But one that sits not far from the Sherlock Holmes statue is one of James Clerk Maxwell, which people may not have heard of James Clerk Maxwell, but actually he was a great influence on Einstein. He was a fantastic physicist.
Yes, I think Einstein said he stood on the shoulders of James Clerk Maxwell. Mm. I find it very difficult to understand, you know, Maxwell's science, but I do know that practically everything we do now, from, you know, computers to everything, to space, to photography, to colours, all started with Maxwell's science. I had a lady on my tour during the course of this year who was an astrophysicist. And I said, now, we're going up India Street. We're going to pass the home of James Clerk Maxwell. Now, you find it quite difficult to know. She just went into absolute ecstasies. She said, no. She said, really? Oh, my dream is to be where he has been. So I said, could you now just explain to the rest of the group?
And you still don't understand it.
I still don't understand it.
I stick to the usual is that he was the first one to produce a colour photograph. That was back in 1861. But I mean, I think as an example of just how far ahead of his time he was, he used pure maths, which is just gobbledygook anyway, to demonstrate that the rings of Saturn could only be made up of small pieces of dust and rock. Now, that was in 1861, but that was only proven right up until the 1970s. And he was only 14. I mean, they went to university early in those days, so he started, you know, producing these discoveries from, you know, the age of 14. Amazing.
And the statue, he's sitting there in a chair in the statue, and he's got in his hand the colour wheel that he devised, or he worked out mathematically how every colour has its own wavelength or something. Mm-hmm. I'm getting too deep now, Liz. I'm going to stop.
You've lost me. I've fallen asleep, actually. Sorry, but I'll wake myself back up again because the statue was created by Sandy Stoddart. He was the sculptor. Now, we mentioned John Steele in the early days of the new town, but nowadays, Sandy Stoddart, a contemporary sculptor, and he has pieces of work all over Edinburgh. And we'll come back to many more of his when we look at the old town, some of the statues to be found in the old town. So a name to reckon with, Sandy Stoddart.
Yes, because he really has made it a life's work to sort of recognise and build statues or create statues to remember some of the people like James Clerk Maxwell who have really been forgotten.
Yep, so we've had royalty.
Not forgotten by scientists, but forgotten by some of the rest of
the
us.
Public. Yeah, we've had royalty, we've had politicians, we've had writers, we've had scientists. But when you walk around Edinburgh, as well as meeting humans, another thing that you regularly meet, animals. There's lots of animal sculptures all over the new town, particularly.
Yes, and one of my favourites in the new town is The Lion of Scotland by Ronald Ray. It's a huge sort of lion sculpted out of red granite from Aberdeen, 20-ton block of it that took over a year to model. But Ronald Ray did a whole lot of animal sculptures, which at one time kind of paraded down by Holyrood. and then they had to be moved. Most of them were then sold on. He's got statues or sculptures all over the UK, and I think some in America as well. Mm-hmm. But the lion was moved from Holyrood up to St Andrew's Square, where it sits. And I've got photographs of my grandson clambering all over it. It's kind of encouraged that children should really appreciate it, feel it, it's tactile, and climb on its back.
It was voted the most popular statue in Edinburgh, but I must confess, I don't get it. I don't like it. But obviously, you know, it's like all art. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, but I think when it was down in Holyrood at the bottom of the Arthur Seat, the shape reflects the shape of Arthur Seat, the extinct volcano in Edinburgh.
Right, too subtle for me. I missed that one. Okay, much, much more in my neck of the woods. Bum the dog. And this is, most of our listeners will have heard of Greyfriars Bobby, and we'll come back to him when we do the old town. But Bum the dog is an icon from San Diego in California.
Yes, and it was just, you know, the two towns or cities, Edinburgh and San Diego, kind of realised that they had a dog at its heart with very similar backgrounds. Both of them were destined for the pound if they didn't have a licence, and both of them were saved by the leading lights of the towns, the provost of the towns. But Bum had a much more
colourful. Sort of,
and risky life, I think, than our lovely wee Bobby.
Wee loyal Bobby, yeah. Yes. No, Bum developed a taste for alcohol because he hung around all the bars in San Diego, and he got into a fight. He picked his fight with a bulldog, which is not particularly a strategic decision to make. And the two dogs, as they were fighting, they backed onto the rail track and they were hit by a train. Now, the other bulldog was killed, but poor old Bum's front right foot was severed by the train, but he survived. And so, you know, people looked after him, felt sorry for him. He became the unofficial mascot. Of course, you've got all this fact and fantasy being fanned by the local newspaper. And so his image became known, just like Greyfriars Bobby did, and he became a national treasure.
A national treasure. And of course, he wasn't content just having his right foot having a wee problem, but he also then, you know, had a rear leg fractured in a kick by a horse. But he was having difficulty, he got arthritis, having difficulty, and he died in 1899 at the local hospital.
I think the expression that we would use there, Helen, is nae luck. Nae luck, Bum.
Nae luck, yes. Nae luck, pal.
But when I was early on in my guiding career, his statue, they swapped statues with San Diego. So they've got one of Greyfriars Bobby, but our one of Bum sits at the entrance, the east entrance to Princes Street Gardens. And I remember stopping with a group in front of it and telling them all about Bum. And one of them said, "Oh, look, he's lost his front leg." And I said, "Don't be silly. He's just lying on top of it." And it was only about 2 years later I found out the story, and they actually
had lost
his leg. Yes. So apologies to all my early tourists who were completely misinformed.
Yeah. No, I like that. He's very easy to miss because he's not in a very obvious place, because he's lying down as well. He's just on the corner there, isn't he? Uh-huh. You can walk past him.
Yep. But you certainly can't walk past another of the animals that's featured in Princes Street Gardens, East Princes Street Gardens, and that's Wojciech the bear. And that's a real story behind Wojciech.
He's my favourite. He was a little bear cub that was rescued by the Polish army in World War II when they were stationed in Iran. Well, he was actually swapped by a little shepherd boy, swapped a little bear cub for corned beef, biscuits, cigarettes, whatever, just, you know, got it. And so the army, this group of soldiers, they looked after Wojciech. They fed him condensed milk in a vodka bottle. I think the vodka was out, as a wee cub to feed him. And then he grew up just eating the same rations as the men, and following out the orders with the men, just wanted to do the same. Men walked on two legs. Wojciech the bear would walk on two legs. Men loaded trucks. Wojciech the bear would load trucks, drinking beer, smoking cigarettes.
And taking showers.
Fantastic story.
Yes, he liked to have a cold shower. He was using up all the water. So he was great entertainment for the Polish soldiers. But it all came to an end because eventually in 1944, the company that he was with had to prepare to ship out. They were going across to Italy to join a military campaign there. And then they came up against military rules because pets weren't allowed in the army and Wojciech was a pet. And so he had to stay behind because it was only enlisted soldiers. So what did the soldiers do? They got him a book and a serial number and they gave him the rank of private and he was permitted to remain. And he travelled with them into Italy. And then eventually they were sent to Scotland after he had played his part. He carried artillery shells and he was just like one of the boys across there. And after the war ended, they came back to Scotland and he eventually ended up in Edinburgh Zoo, where he was a major attraction for many years.
And I saw him there when we used to
go to
the zoo.
Quite...
But he was there, and the enclosure, I mean, the zoos have improved an awful lot since then, but he had his own enclosure. But the enclosure, when he died in the 1960s, not the 1860s, in the 1960s. And the pandas who have just left us, where Wojciech was, that was part of that was where the pandas were.
Right.
But Wojciech, when the Polish soldiers used to come to the zoo to visit him, he recognised them and they would bring him presents of cigarettes and beer and biscuits. And, you know, he was really loved. And Peter Prentice, I think is his name, Prentice, he was the soldier who took care of Wojciech in the army. And he is the one who is in part of the group, the statue group, the sculpture group with Wojciech.
Oh, yeah, and you mentioned there the pandas. And for those that aren't in the UK and are listening to this, for a long time we've had a link with China. Edinburgh had very strong links. It's got a Confucius Institute, very strong links, not least because of the Royal Botanic Gardens, where they have a huge store of seeds, many of which have plants from China, which are actually extinct in China. And so on the back of this really strong relationship, we were given two pandas initially for 10 years with the idea that they would mate and that they would have their own cubs at Edinburgh. This didn't happen. They didn't go to plan. And so it was extended for 2 years over the pandemic. But eventually this week, really sad, the two, Chang Chang and what's the other one? I can't remember. But they've gone back to Chengdu in China, which I've actually visited. And I think that they would much prefer to have, that was several years ago I visited. But I'm sure that the conditions were much better in their lovely enclosure at Edinburgh. But they'll be welcomed home with open arms.
Yes, I think Mr. Panda was not too keen on Mrs. Panda.
Obviously, for 12 years.
For 12 years, I know.
No luck again, no luck for the pandas.
He's maybe got a wee girlfriend back home he was being loyal to.
Oh, we can have a whole story to ourselves here, Helen. The mind boggles. But another one, and a very poignant one, away from all the humour, the other little one, not far from Wojciech, we've got a little baby elephant.
It's a beautiful sculpture by Andy Scott of a baby elephant. And the fact that we know that elephants never forget, that is so important, because this was a little... place, a little statue, a little something for the baby ashes scandals. Many babies who were still born, etc., came to light in the 2012 that their ashes had been buried just without thought, really. And the parents obviously found that very, very hard. And this is somewhere where they can go and know that their babies are never forgotten.
Yeah, and of course, Andy Scott, famous for the Kelpies, that's one of his most famous. But also on the elephant, it's covered in little forget-me-nots.
Beautiful.
Beautiful little sculpture. But one of my favourites, one that I really do like to finish up with, just not far from James Clerk Maxwell and Sherlock Holmes, we've got two giant giraffes Their official name is Dreaming Spires, but they've been nicknamed Martha and Gilbert, mother and son. And these have been made up from scrap metal, metal taken from motorbikes and cars, anything that she could find. The artist is Helen Dennerly, and they stand outside the Omni Centre, which is a big leisure and recreation centre in the East End of Edinburgh. So I love that. I love the giraffes. Not so cute.
I love them. The lion. And if you actually go and look at them, you can actually see the bits of the motorbike, you can see the bits of car, you can see the fairing, you can see the doors, you can see all sorts of bits that, you know, a non-engineer recognises. The engineers will recognise hundreds of bits. Non-engineers can see some of it.
I sense a social media post coming on there, very photogenic. We'll get the giraffes up on the thing. So, I mean, we could carry on. There's so many statues, and we will come back to this. We'll do one on the statues of the old town of Edinburgh, and there's a good one that we'll do one of the women who are coming to the fore more and more nowadays.
Yeah, there's quite a campaign going on about the women, yeah. So that'll be a good episode.
Exactly. So it's time for Word of the Week, Helen. I've got a very simple one because we're talking about sculptors here, artists that make things. And in Scotland, the traditional word for some sort of person that's creative, that's making something, be it poetry or art, or in this case, sculptures, is a maker, M-A-K-A-R. So the makers were people like Sandy Stoddart and John Steele making these fantastic sculptures.
Yes, well, that's very highbrow, Liz. Mine's a little less, mine's a bit more lowbrow.
Oh, that's good that the boot is on the other foot, as they say.
Yes, well, we were talking about the dog from San Diego called Bum. And of course, if he was a dog from Scotland, he wouldn't be called Bum, he'd be called Bahookie. Bahookie, because Bahookie is the Scottish word for a bum. So,
a bottom.
Or your backside, or a bottom, yes.
So Bahookie the Dug. Bahookie the Dug.
Bahookie the Dug, yes.
And Bahookie the Dug brings this episode to a close. So it's been a pleasure as always.
Yes, I've enjoyed that, Liz, and enjoy your holiday. You're off to sunshine.
Yes, hopefully, yes. So a little, this is our normal, we have a family break to Palma for the Christmas markets in Palma. So looking forward to that this week. But we'll be back again. We've got them in the bag now, so we're getting back online again. So hopefully people are enjoying. And remember, as always, if there's something that you would like to hear us talk about, then please drop us a line.
Yes. So, well, thank you, Liz, and goodbye and good night.
Good night.
And there we have it, the end of another episode of Scottish Blethers. If you'd like to join us on social media, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as @ScottishBlethers. And if you'd like to leave a review, please do so on your podcast platform of choice. It's cheery bye from me.
Ta-ta the loo from me.
And if I don't see you through the week, I'll see you through the windy from me.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.